In 1973, there was held in Seattle what I understand was the first charismatic leaders conference. And I was privileged to be one of those who attended. There were a number of questions that were raised. In fact, the conference was called because already the charismatic thing was starting to, at least in terms of subject matter, it was starting to fragment. A lot of things were being said that had already become controversial. The question of deliverance was controversial. The question of water baptism was controversial. There were a number of things that had already, in 1973, become controversial. And it was the intention of those who called this conference to bring together men who were having, who were exercising some influence in forming the opinions and setting the direction of the, quote, charismatic community. Probably the major concern at that point was deliverance. And when we came together, a lot of these things were discussed. Late one afternoon, the question was asked, do we know where we are going? And there were several things said about that. And I, with more boldness than modesty, said, I believe I know where we are going and where we should be going. And it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And so they asked if I would come up and tell them where we are going, where we should be going. And I said at 4 o'clock, I wouldn't try to do that. Your blood sugar is at the lowest all day, and this is no time to get into something like this. But if you will give me the first session in the morning, I'll talk about where we're going, which I did. And that was the beginning of what I'm going to give you in these 4 sessions. And I need to say to you that I haven't altered my view one whit. In fact, it has been amplified and underscored and intensified in my own mind and spirit. I believe that it has made some contribution to the molding of a lot of positions, and I believe that the time for me to share it with you, and that's what we're going to be doing. If you don't know where you're going, it's very easy to wander. If you have no idea where you're going, then it's very easy for you to get lost. I don't believe that God has left us in the dark as to the beginning and the ending of history. When George spoke of me referring to God as a world person, that isn't just a kind of an innocuous remark. That is deeply fundamental. He is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. He started it, and he's going to finish it. Now, he's told us how he started it. Has he given us any indication of how he's going to finish it? And it's at that point that we want to direct our concern. I'm going to read several New Testament passages tonight, and I'm going to read them carefully and deliberately, and ask you to follow, if you have your Bible, the best you can with whatever Bible you've got. Do you remember the good old days when we used to say, let us all turn and read together? If I were to ask you to all turn and read together, it would sound like the Tower of Babel. How many have New American Standard Bibles tonight? Well, they're still hanging in, aren't they? How many have got NIV? How many have got Authorized? Oh, isn't that a tragedy? King James will be having post-burial fits. How many got other breeds and brands? Now, you see what I mean? If we were to read, wouldn't it sound strange? So I'm going to read, and you do your best to follow with whatever you've got. All right. Romans 15. Romans 15, verse 4. And also verses 8 and 9. Whatever was written in the scriptures in days gone by was written for our instruction, so that through patient endurance and through the encouragement drawn from the scriptures, we might hold fast to our hope. Now, I'd just like to stop there for a couple of sessions. Because our hope is not something that we vaguely hope will happen and don't know what it is. Our hope in the New Testament is something that has been clearly revealed and to which we have committed ourselves in a faith proposition to make a cornerstone of our whole philosophy of life and history. We're saved by that, saved from a lot of things. But it comes through the scriptures. Now, verses 8 and 9. Now, I say that Jesus Christ was a minister to the circumcision, in behalf of God's truth, in carrying out the promises made to our forefathers, and that the Gentiles might praise God for his mercy, as Scripture says, for this cause I will confess to thee among the Gentiles and sing in honor of thy name. Now, the only scriptures that were available when Paul wrote these words were the Old Testament scriptures. And that gives you some idea of the importance of the Old Testament scriptures in playing their part in forming God's revelation of history and divine intention in history and divine intention for his creation and divine intention for the people whom he created to place in that creation. The second reading is in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, commencing at verse 1. You should understand, my brothers, how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all underwent baptism as followers of Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat of the same supernatural food, and did all drink the same supernatural drink, for they drank of that supernatural rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with the great majority of them, God was not well pleased. For they were overthrown in the wilderness. Or as the New English Bible says, the desert was strewn with their corpses. These events are examples to us, warning us, that we should not crave evil things as they also crave, neither worship false gods, as some of them did. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us sin sexually, as some of them did, and fell in one day 23,000. Let us stop trying the Lord's patience, as some of them also tried his patience and were destroyed as serpents. And you must stop grumbling, as some of them also grumbled and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now, this is a very important verse. Now, these things which happened to our ancestors are illustrations of the way in which God works and were recorded for our benefit as a warning. In whose lives the climax of the ages has been reached. Or, as another translation said, we are the heirs of the ages which have gone before us. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth be careful that he does not fall. For there is no temptation that has come your way that is too hard for flesh and blood to bear. For God can be depended on not to allow you to suffer any temptation beyond your powers of endurance. He will see to it that every temptation has a way out so that you can come through it victoriously. Wherefore, my dearly beloved, keep on running from idolatry. I speak to you as men of discernment. Form your own judgment on what I say. The next one is in Hebrews chapter 3. I hope you don't find the reading of the scriptures boring. Because it is terribly important that we have a biblical base for some of the things we're going to say, because some of them are going to be very radical. Chapter 3 of Hebrews, starting at verse 7. Wherefore, as the Holy Ghost saith, or is saying, today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts as in the provocation, on the day when they tried my patience in the desert, as they tried my patience and tested me, and saw my mighty deeds for 40 years, wherefore I was grieved, displeased, provoked, exasperated, vexed, angry, and indignant. All of those words are synonyms of the Greek word. I was grieved with that generation. As we read on, let me point out to you that we're talking, and we will amplify this more later, we are talking about the corporate. All of the pronouns here are plural. It's a people. It's a generation. In fact, it's about 3 million people that's being talked about. What is being talked about is the church that failed under Moses. Verse 11, so I bowed in my anger. They shall not be admitted to my rest. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief, or a wickedness of heart which refuses to trust. Trust what? Trust whom? For what? We're not talking here about trusting God for the rent. We're not talking here about trusting God for stomach ulcers. We're talking here about a generation of men and women who would not trust God to fulfill His destiny for them in going in as a people, cleaning out the land of Canaan and establishing a theocracy. So let's be clear on the basis of their unbelief. Verse 13. On the contrary, encourage one another day after day, while there is a today, or so long as today lasts, to prevent anyone among you from being hardened. Hardened about what? Hardened about believing and bending every effort to do what God wants us to do as a people in history. Now, I'm not being an evangelist in these meetings. I'd be happy if someone perchance come in that didn't know the Lord and found Him. But in these four sessions, my job is to save saints, not sinners. And to save saints from a lesser vision than God intends them to hold. We are talking about a specific objective to which faith must be directed. And it's a corporate faith which requires us to encourage one another daily. Let me digress just for a moment. I've just come back, as I said, from Great Britain. Great Britain is no exception to other nations. We have our own messes here. But one of the things I think that profoundly disgusted me and told me or suggested to me how far along the road Western civilization is to the kind of decadence it is going to precipitate a divine crisis of intervention and salvation. They are now trying to legalize a pedophile society in Great Britain, which means that adult sexual relationships with children should be considered normal. This was getting frontline coverage, being discussed, and those who were supporting it were brazenly suggesting that it was another step forward to go along with Britain having been in the vanguard of giving homosexuality acceptance. I just mention that because as we go along, you're going to see how pertinent things like that are. But exhort one another daily. While there is a today, to prevent any among you from being hardened through the delusive glamour of sin. I don't think any of us are aware of how vulnerable we are because of our humanness and our fallenness to the subtle erosion of the constant bombardment of public propaganda by a vocal minority to break down normal decencies and modesties and defeat the purposes of God. And so we need to exhort one another. Verse 14, for we are made partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast unto the end. Seeing that the warning still comes to us. Today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your heart as in the provocation. For who were they that heard and yet provoked God? Were they not all whom Moses brought forth out of Egypt? Who were these people that provoked God? Were they a bunch of Egyptian idolaters? No. These were people who had had the Passover blood applied. They had come through the Red Sea and been baptized unto Moses in the waters of the Red Sea. And had been baptized by the cloud. Had come out on the shores of resurrection. Had seen the miracle of the annihilation of the Egyptian army as the waters piled up on either side, suddenly loosed and drowned them. These were people who knew God. Verse 17, but with whom was he grieved 40 years? Was it not with them that had sinned, whose carcasses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he vow that they should not be admitted to his rest, but to them that were disobedient? So that we see they could not be admitted because of their unwillingness to adhere to and trust and rely on God. Unbelief had shut them out. Let off. Who? Us. Delivered people. Passover, Red Sea, cloud, manna, water out of the flinty rock, clothes grown on our backs, people. Let us fear, lest while the promise of entering into his rest still holds, none of you may be found to be delinquent. For indeed we have had good tidings preached unto us just as they had. But the word preached did not profit them because it did not meet with faith in them. One more. 1 Peter 2:9-10. But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praise of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who at one time were a no people, but now are a people of God. Outside his mercy once, you have now receive his mercy. Now, in the reading of those scriptures, we've tried to lay a foundation for the things we're going to be talking about. Does the Bible give clear teaching about what God intends his people to be, to do, and become? I think it does. In giving such teaching, the New Testament writers put forth God's ideal for the nation Israel as a type of his intention for new covenant people. Can I stop here and attempt to make a point that I may try to make several times? When you are reading the Old Testament, you will read things that have to do with the age of Messiah that are put in the language of God's dealings with Israel, which have a larger intention for this new covenant age. And you must understand that. These things were happened to them as examples for us upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Paul gives us an example of that kind of interpretation, or hermeneutic, or principle of interpretation, when he says, "Brothers, understand how that all our fathers passed through the Red Sea or were baptized under Moses in the sea and in the cloud." Now, what's he doing? He's taking something that happened to Israel and he's applying it to a whole new company of people. So that when we're finding out what God did for Israel, remember that many of the things that happened in Israel and to Israel and with Israel, he deliberately says, happened to them as examples or types or pictures for us upon whom the climax of the ages have come. What's he mean by that? He means that what God did with Israel was not even in God's mind final. That everything that God did with Israel, everything God did in the Old Testament, was with a view to the New Testament. But the New Testament isn't doing things with a view to a newer testament. And so we have come upon the ends of the ages, the climax of history, the fulfillment, the age of the fullness of time. This is it. The validity of all we are going to say during these sessions rests upon the premise that Israel's history has divinely intended significance. Please note the emphasis is on God's purpose for his people, corporately considered. I want to suggest, I've held this now for several years, that the individual emphasis in preaching and teaching has tended to overshadow God's purpose for his people corporately. We have saved souls. I've got saved, I've got my baptism, I've been baptized in water, I've taken my first communion, I'm going to the church of my choice. I'm a glorious independent. The New Testament doesn't know anything about a Christian out of community. Baptism is not only into Christ redemptively, it is into Christ's body functionally. And the corporate is that which is going to fulfill God's world purpose. Now, some of us, in the enthusiastic days of our individual soul-saving efforts, and I don't want to give the impression I'm running that down, carried as a corollary of that the idea that God was going to raise some startling, magnificent, prophetic figure. The singleness of our philosophy created a singleness all the way through. And we saw some great man flashing on history. The great man that is going to flash on history is a many-membered corporate man made up of a community of redeemed men and women who in their corporiety are going to manifest all the attributes of God as they have been seen historically in Jesus Christ. There will be outstanding men. There will be prophets and apostles. But the corporate man that is going to bring history to its climax of glory is the many-membered man of the community of Christ. Christianity is essentially a social religion. To turn it into a solitary religion is indeed to destroy it. You know who said that? John Wesley. John Wesley formed society. You know that when the communists wanted to know how to be corporately successful, they recognized that John Wesley had been about as successful as anybody in creating effective, history-changing communities. And they got their whole cell system from Mr. Wesley's class meeting. Now, to show you how effective Mr. Wesley was, profane historians who have little or no sympathy for the Christian thing admit that it was John Wesley's societies of dedicated Christians who hurled the French Revolution back across the channel and forbid it to bring its rottenness into Great Britain. Now, we think of Wesley as teaching entire sanctification and getting people converted. What I want to say is that because Wesley saw that Christianity is not a solitary religion, but it is a corporate religion, and he formed societies, disciplined societies, highly disciplined societies. So highly disciplined that the communists didn't hesitate to take the very format of Wesley's class meetings as a format for their own cell meetings. Because they saw that Wesley had put a discipline into his community that it had such an influence that it had affected history. Profane historians said that Wesley and his Christian societies altered the history of England for 100 years. I'm talking about an ultimate community that's going to alter the history of the world with a finality that is going to precipitate the coming of the Lord. What was God's purpose for Israel? What was God's purpose for Israel? Exodus 3:8. I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land unto a good land and a large. Notice the preposition. What is our question? What was God's purpose for Israel? Now, Israel had other ideas, but we want to know what was God's purpose. You know, the corporate Christian thing in the earth tonight isn't a lot different from Israel in many ways. The reason that Israel did not ultimately fulfill the will of God for them was that they preferred their own ideas. The question is, what was God's purpose for Israel? And the companion question inferred in that, of course, is, what is God's purpose for us? It was to bring them out of and into. Out of is not enough. And yet, I'll say to you, out of has been almost the total emphasis of evangelical Christianity. God saved me from this, and God saved me from that, and God saved me from good. What did he save you to? Well, I go to church every Sunday morning. Now, that's your idea. What's his idea? You see, I'm not a cynic. I have faith. I may sound cynical. But I get just a little disturbed when I find people terribly impressed with big churches and big meetings, when all the time Jesus is looking for Christian nations. He said, go into all the world and make disciples of nations. He said, do you know how many we got in Sunday school? Well, if you had 10,000 in Sunday school, that's still not a nation. You see, the thing that impresses us doesn't impress him. I'm going to have you travel with me, ma'am. Exodus chapter 6. Verse 6. Wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am Jehovah. That's the signature of the God who is speaking. Say unto the children of Israel, I am Jehovah. Having announced who I am, whatever I have to say I can handle. Wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am Jehovah, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will rid you out of their bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments, and I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God, and ye shall know that I am Jehovah your God, who bringeth you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you in. Let's say it all together. I will bring you in. Now, who's he talking to? Did you notice in the Hebrews passage where this whole matter is being discussed in the New Testament? He was talking about a generation. He was talking about people. The pronouns were plural. He's not saying, I'll bring you in, Ern and Bill and Mary and Pete. He's saying, I'll bring you in. I brought you all out. Now, I want to take you all in. I will bring you in unto the land which I swear to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and I will give it to you for a heritage. I am Jehovah. He signs his letters on both ends. Deuteronomy 6:23. Deuteronomy 6:23. And he brought us out from thence, that he might bring us. What did he bring us out for? Oh, he didn't bring us out just to bring us out. How about enough of we got out? Well, it is if you want to wander in the wilderness for 40 years and die. He brought us out from thence that he might bring us in to give us the land which he sware unto our fathers. One more. Deuteronomy 8:15. We're answering a question, remember. What was God's purpose for Israel? In Deuteronomy 8:15, he says, who led thee through the great and terrible wilderness? Psalm 107:4 says that they wandered in the wilderness. God's intention was to bring them through. They chose to wander. All right, three prepositions. Out of, through, and into. Our corporate life has not been understood if those three prepositions are not fundamental to our whole Christian philosophy of history. And I repeat, at the risk of being unfair, evangelicalism has not had an into emphasis. In fact, it hasn't had much of a corporate emphasis. It's been getting you and me saved, getting us out of something, and then doing our own thing in the wilderness. Every man has his own oasis. There's the oasis of the continual revival, the friendly oasis. Read your Saturday Scandal page and find out what characterizes all the oases. Now, Joe did a thing for me, and I'm going to ask him to, I'll ask to have it put up. This is just a little simple diagram. Egypt out of. That's the crisis beginning. Here's the process of getting through. Now bring it over, Fred. Here's the wilderness. And that's the training process. And here's the land. That's the permanent vocation. Now let's go back again. All right, hold it right there. In the beginning, we're brought out of Egypt through the Passover. And the things that were distinctive about Egypt, I think, can be reduced to about three. I'm sorry you can't see that thing totally all at once, but Egypt, in the Old Testament, especially as it had to do with the deliverance of the nation of Israel, represented the whole humanist, diabolical complex opposed to God. Egypt has always represented that. It was marked by materialism. Egyptologists tell us of the tremendous material wealth of Egypt. It was marked by humanism, and it was marked by diabolism or demonism or idolatry. It was anti-God, as is pointed out so specifically in Pharaoh's arrogant attitude to Jehovah. Who is this Jehovah? It represents diabolical political tyranny and despotism. God had to deal with the satanic. He had to deal with the worldly. And he had to deal with the moral. I'm trying to make this as simple as I can. There were three things in connection with Egypt that are permanent in terms of what is opposed to God. The diabolical, the rebelliously human, and the moral government of God in handling it. Now these three things mark the whole ungodly society. It's always been that way. Right from the beginning, right from the garden. When Satan deceived Eve, he appealed to her sense of human determinism. And he said, hath God said? God knows that in the day you eat of that fruit, you're going to be like he. Your eyes are going to be open. The reason he doesn't want you to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil is that if you eat of that fruit, you'll be a competition to him. And so you have the satanic lie appealing to something in Eve that responded. What responded in Eve was a subtle desire to be her own boss. Now, I'm not going to go into that in detail. Humanism, very simply, is man's desire. Now, this sounds crazy. And it is. Humanism is man's desire to run his own destiny by a consensus of his own counsel. Eve believed the lie and decided that she'd be like God. And to this present day, humanism in all its forms is the arrogant claim of man to have the capacity to run his own affairs without any supernatural being in the earth. So you have the satanic and you have the humanist, and they are allies. See, we wonder why humanism is so successful. It is successful because it is diabolically supported. It's satanically supported. It is Satan supporting man in his opposition to the government of God. So man sets up his own government. Now, I don't have any sophisticated scenario for what's going to happen. Nor does anybody else. That's the closest thing to a chart that I've got. In fact, it is an axiom of prophecy that you don't really know what a prophecy is going to be like until it's fulfilled. I do know that the God has said he's going to do certain things in history through the redeemed community. I don't know how. But he's going to do it. Now, humanism is claiming the right, apart from God, by its own published manifesto, where it declares out and out that it does not believe in any superior power, but by the apparatus of its own fallen mind and consensus, that it is going to affect its own life and destiny. What we are looking at now may be one of two things, and this is going to disappoint some of you, but I have to be straightforward with you. We may be close to to the climax of history in the ultimate sense. On the other hand, we may be at one of those historic, epical points where an entire phase of human life and society is cashing in. Arnold Toynbee says that probably some 23 civilizations have come and gone, scarcely leaving a trace of their having been here. I don't want to be running down England. I just happen to have been there for 5 weeks, and I've been exposed to the English humanism. Since I've come back to America in 1 week, I've got a pretty good dose of it here, too. But I noticed gynecologists in the area where I was staying hit the headlines because he had aborted a child, a 32-week fetus. And when he saw it was alive, he had put it in a sluice, which I would think was some kind of a disposal sink, and had walked away. Some nurses discovered the child and it was alive. And they took it to the proper hospital facilities and revived it, and the child is well and healthy. The doctor was tried and completely exonerated. I heard him interviewed, and it was all I could do to keep from kicking the television in. It wasn't really the television I had in mind. The whole obnoxious defense that he put up in a sentimental, mawkish way on that television interview was what he had suffered during this time, what others were suffering as a result of this whole thing becoming known. It was a disgusting demonstration of the almost total disintegration of decency. Apart from a few hardy souls, the decision was applauded. I don't want to get into the whole abortion thing here tonight, other than to say that when man makes the determination that it is his right to dispense with life, they had a number of discussions, and one of them had on its panel a very straightforward professor of a university who I don't think was a Christian. I'm relatively sure he wasn't, but it was a very straightforward person. He was asked when life began. And he said, in that moment when the male seed and the female come together, he said, that's it. And that was the beginning. Now, I'm not a gynecologist or a biologist or anything else. But I do know this, that the Bible tells me that God forms me in my mother's womb. And what we are doing in the whole abortion thing is not only murdering life in the womb, but we are coming against the whole creative purpose of God. Because historical theology has taught for centuries that while the mother gives the child life in the sense of providing it with a body, that God is the one who in that moment of conception imparts to it that thing that makes it different to any other creature and gives to it the kind of life that is God-like. So man is coming against creation. Now people say it isn't important, creation. Creation is terribly important. Because if God didn't create, then God doesn't own.
God's creation makes him proprietor. And you better run his creation by his rule. Now, it's only a step from prenatal abortion to infanticide, to euthanasia for the aged. Once we determine that out of our corporate humanist wisdom we know how to handle situations, out of our godlessness, we are going to play our own God and destroy ourselves. Now, what I am saying is that sounds very ultimate, and it looks as if humanism has won. But here's where faith has got to operate. God has declared his intention. When Israel wouldn't go into the land of Kadesh Barnea and they turned back, God was angry, and he had a session with Moses. He says, Moses, I'm going to wipe that bunch out, and I'll make a whole new nation out of you. Moses said, don't do it. Don't do it. It's hard on your reputation, God. Don't do it. If you kill them off, then the nations will say you couldn't handle the job. Don't do it. Forgive them. Pardon them. He said, I'll pardon them. But in the midst of that, he said, they will not go into the land. Now, he pardoned them, but they didn't go in. They got out, but they didn't get in. But there were a pardoned people out, but didn't get in. Now, put that in your theological pipe and smoke it. But listen to what he said. He put a little parenthesis in there out of his own great heart, for he is the God who said he will not be discouraged until he have set judgment in the earth. Listen to what he said. But as truly as I live. Now here's this whole nation that he brought out of Egypt. Sent them 40 trainloads of manna every morning. Give them water out of the flinty rock. Fought their enemies. Supernaturally, they have their own private cloud. All the other nations peeking up over the sand dunes said, who is that with their own private cloud? He brought them to the point where he wanted to bring them into their destiny. And at Kadesh, they opted out. And he sees this host of people drawing back from their destiny. And he says to Moses, out of his own infinite faith and confidence in his own purposes, he said, Moses, they have failed, and other generations may fail. But as truly as I live, I base my character on it. I base my name on it. I base my character on it. As truly as I live, Moses, that day will come sometime in history when there will be a generation of people who will fill the earth with my glory, not just a little hunk in the middle. Yeah. Somebody says, that's exciting. How's he going to do it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. But I know that he said, as truly as I live, I'm going to do it. Now, he had to do three things to get them out of Egypt. He had to deal with the diabolism, the devil factor. He had to deal with the humanist factor, and he had to deal with his own moral government. He dealt with the humanist factor processively. He started the plagues. Pharaoh kept rebelling. At last he said, all right, Pharaoh, I've hit your humanism again and again. You couldn't withstand the flies, and you couldn't withstand the bloody waters, and you couldn't withstand the boils, and you couldn't withstand. Now, I'm going to get you at the place of your pride. I'm going to kill all your firstborn. That takes care of humanism. But
But then the Bible also says that he judged the gods of Egypt. He dealt with Pharaoh as the head of the whole humanist system. But every one of those plagues was directed at a god of Egypt. And he judged their gods. He proved there was no god like unto Jehovah. There was none beside him. There was none like him. He was God alone. Independent, unilateral. Counsels with no one. Does what he jolly well pleases because he's infinitely good and his counsels are supreme and there is no god like him. And he proved that in Egypt by dealing with all of the gods of Egypt and humiliating them under his feet. And then he dealt with Pharaoh himself, the great head of the humanist situation. But his people were in there and his people were also sinners. What was he going to do about that? He had the power to deal with humanism out of his providence. He had the power to deal with the devils out of his power. How does he deal with his own moral government? How is he going to get that sinful nation out of Egypt? There we have again the revelation of vicarious redemptive suffering. And he gave them the message of the Passover. And he said, this is the way and the only way I'll get my people out of Egypt. He said, I want you to take a lamb for a household. I want you to slay it, and I want you to take the blood, and I want you to sprinkle it on the doorpost. And when the death angel comes by, I will pass over you. Now, we often think that when we say that we mean that the death angel passed by. But that word Passover means hover over. What Jehovah said was, you put the blood on the doorpost and I'll flutter over it. And when that destroying angel comes by, he's not going to just see blood. He's going to see me fluttering over that blood. I will flutter over the blood. The thing that makes Jesus' blood so powerful is that that's the blood that Jehovah identifies with. And on the basis of that blood, he brought out 3 million people that night. Not only did he bring them out, but he brought them out wealthy. He did something to the Egyptian. He made them all vulnerable. And most of those Israelitish women were domestics, and on the night that they were going to leave, when they were leaving their mistress's home, they just confronted their mistress and very simply said, Madam, I'd like your jewelry. And all these Egyptian women brought the jewelry out and handed them to their domestic slave. And they spoiled the Egyptian. Think about it. The riches of the Gentile. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. The world and all that dwell therein. They got out of Egypt by power. They got out of Egypt not only by blood, but they got out of Egypt by power. But something else happened to them that probably at the time it happened didn't seem to have the kind of significance that it came to have in the New Covenant. Why didn't God just bring them from Egypt and take them right into the land? Why did he bring them by the Red Sea? Why did he take them on a circuitous route? He didn't even take them directly. Why did he do that? Why did he take them through the Red Sea? Because in going through the Red Sea, it had something to do with their identification in a life-death relationship to Moses that Paul calls being baptized unto Moses. That's why baptism becomes a God-ordained means whereby a repentant sinner confesses his identity with the new Moses, Jesus,
who brought him out by blood and wants to bring him on through and in by identification with his power. And then he didn't lead him to his own devices. He provided him with a cloud. And Paul said that they were baptized under Moses in the sea and in the cloud. And so we have the thing that Peter said in the day of Pentecost, repent and be baptized, every one of you, and receive the gift of the Holy Ghost. The Peter package didn't start in the day of Pentecost. Moses had the Peter package. Of course, it was the Moses package back there. But it was the same message. I'm just going to take one more verse and then we're finished. Exodus chapter 12 and verse 25. We're going to talk about the wilderness and we're going to talk about the land. And the land is the exciting thing. We've all talked about Egypt and we've all talked about the wilderness. How many of us ever heard sermons on the land? How many know what the land is? If Egypt typifies something, if the blood typifies something, if the Red Sea typifies something, if the cloud typifies something, if the manna typifies something, if the rock out of which the water came typifies something, what does the land typify? Exodus 12:25. And it will come about when you enter the land which the Lord will give you, as he has promised, that you shall observe this rite of the Passover. The Passover was with a view to the land. The night those Israelites sprinkled blood on the doorpost and stood with staff in hand and loins girt, eating the freshly roasted lamb to get ready for their journey, God says, you don't know it, but you're standing here tonight in this emergency situation with the blood on the doorpost, and you're standing here because my purpose is to take you out of this bondage and bring you into the land. And when you come into the land, you're going to celebrate this rite because you're going to realize that you have taken over the land because of the blood of this passage. The land is always in view. The land is what we want to talk about.